Morning. This is Joseph Gainza. So my guest this morning is Sam Clark. Sam is a builder, designer, and cabinet maker based in both Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Plainfield, Vermont. He's written several books on design and building, including The Motion-Minded Kitchen and The Independent Builder. This book, The Inland Sea, is his first mystery. Sam is well known by people living here in central Vermont. He's been here since 1960, building, designing, and being an active member of the Plainfield Food Co-op in downtown Plainfield. So Sam Clark, it's great to have you on Gathering Peace. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it very much.
Well, it's my pleasure. I really enjoyed the book, but let's start there. You've written books, but they're more of a technical nature, having to do with your primary work, which is woodworking and cabinet making. And this is a mystery, a murder mystery of a different sort than ones that I'm used to reading. How come you decided on that genre for your next book?
I had been trying to find a way to write about two closely related things. One was the water and being on the water and what that meant to me. The experience of life on the water, if you will. But the other is a certain kind of family, like my own family, a certain kind of New England Christian, well-intentioned family, and that goes, you know, far back in this New England world, but which is a little out of place in the modern world. So I had been trying different ways to write about these things, which seemed to me closely related, if that makes any sense. So I have a stack of manuscripts on this general topic, which were sort of unsuccessful. And then on election day, 2008, I was biking along the lower road out here and was hit by a car and pretty badly banged up so that I couldn't do my regular work, but I could still sit in my chair, which is actually this same space that I'm in right now. And I could, with a little care, I could type. And for some reason, I had the idea of, well, maybe I could write about these things which interest me so much in the form of fiction and in the form of a mystery story. And I had certain kinds of mysteries that I had enjoyed reading and rereading over the years. And that was a part of my inspiration there too, is to write about good people trying to deal with confusing situations, if that makes sense.
Well,
that's kind of how it happened. It was
Could
have been literally an accident that it happened.
Literally. Well, I'm glad to know that you're back on your feet, but you used your time productively. It's a really interesting book, The Inland Sea. You know, I've lived in Vermont for 47 years. I never knew that section of the Lake Champlain was called the Inland Sea. I had never seen it on a map. I had never heard it referred to that way. So that was an eye-opener right there as soon as I picked up the book and saw the map that you provide so that we can follow the various movements of the various people that inhabit your book. So the Inland Sea, you spend a lot of time there?
I kind of grew up in the Adirondacks in the summertime. And I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, I was looking for a way to get back on the water. And there was an ad in the Times Argus for a trailer in South Hero. little house trailer on the lake for sale and that I could afford. It was $13,000. So we started spending, we bought that trailer and spent a lot of time up on that part of Lake Champlain. And I got really, and I've continued to be interested in the lake and all of the different bodies of water that connect to it. So I've spent my childhood boating, and then more recently done a lot of boating and being on the lake here. So that's been actually a wonderful new thing for me. I'd lived in Vermont all these years and had never really participated, enjoyed this amazing lake that is right there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
For all of us. And so once I started doing that,
Now, how familiar are you with the social life on the lake? Because there's an awful lot of that in your book. The main character, Detective Fred Davis, grew up on a farm on one of the islands in the middle of Lake Champlain. And the action all takes place on the lake. So are you familiar with people who live there? And
we met some folks. But I'm really talking about a kind of person, I would say. I don't know, you know, there's islands there that I name that have characters on them that I made up. Uh-huh. But I've spent, you know, a lot of my life in the Adirondacks as a younger person has found its way into this story. And I guess that's my answer. I don't know. Yeah. I don't actually, I've never met the people that own Savage Island.
The reason why
I do because I populated it with people that my story demands should live there.
Well, it they're interesting people, and the reason I'm spending time on it because I got very involved with the characters, and knowing the physical location where it is. With those islands, I was able to imagine myself being part of this story. And the way you construct your plot, you do bring the reader in a very interesting way, because we hear an interview that the detective, Fred Davis, has with the son of the person who was killed. JB is the son. We hear the story that JB gives to the detective. And then the next chapter, you, the narrator, comes in and says, well, this is what really happened. So we are brought in as the reader. We become more knowledgeable than the characters in the book. And we become part of the process of trying to figure out what's going on here. What's happening? I thought that was a very interesting plot structure. Is that something that you made up yourself, or have you seen that elsewhere?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't have an answer to that. I want to go one step to what you asked about, do I know these people? And I want to mention that a lot of this plot has to do with the islands within the Inland Sea.
Right.
And the world of islands and the people who live on them is something I'm very familiar with from my life in the Adirondacks. So to some extent, I kind of transposed the people on the islands that I knew years ago in the Adirondacks. A lot of the plot takes place on an island that I literally lifted out of Upper Saranac Lake and flew across and dropped into the middle of Lake Champlain. And the plot is a lot centered around this island that is not in Lake Champlain at all, but somewhere else altogether. So,
oh, I didn't realize that. Osprey Island?
Osprey Island is really, in my mind, Birch Island on Upper Saranac Lake, where I spent a lot of my life. So that's why I know it so well, because I spent so much time there. So I just literally picked it up and moved it for the sake of the story to this location.
That's really interesting.
I lost track of it. And in your other point too about that plot device, where I, as you say, invite the reader in to know things that aren't, that the protagonists don't know. I don't know. That was just what occurred to me when I wrote it that way.
And yeah, yeah.
It wasn't really a device that I came to some other way.
Yeah, well,
because the story needed that.
Well, it worked for me, because the what the narrator tells us there, when you're reading the rest of the investigation, and the story is primarily about Vermont state troopers and local police investigating a murder that occurs on one of those islands. We can tell that. I don't want to give away this the book, but we could tell that. But because I now, as the reader, know something about the backstory, the true story, what really happened, when they're coming close to a piece of evidence, or a piece of evidence comes in front of them that they don't realize the importance of it, I, as the reader, do. And so it created a real connection to the story that I don't know that I would have had otherwise. So it's an interesting plot device that you
I think it's not unusual in a mystery story for the reader to know things up front that the people in the story don't know yet.
Uh-huh.
I think that's it didn't strike me when I did that it was so weird, but it's true that it's not like an Agatha Christie where you find out at the end of the book
right
who the killer is,
right,
or any of that. You learn that right away. What you don't learn is, why did this happen to this person in this way? Why did this person kill this person?
Right.
What was that about? What was the meaning of that? That's the part that unfolds, I would say.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm not much of a mystery reader, but my mother used to read Agatha Christie all the time, so I'm more used to that construction. So we're talking with Sam Clark. He has a new book out. It's a murder mystery that's located on the Inland Sea, a part of Lake Champlain. It's called The Inland Sea. So Sam, when is the book coming out?
December 9th.
December 9th. So coming up pretty soon.
How
long did it take you to write it? You said you were in an accident in 2008, so...
I worked on it at that time, but then I wasn't able to find a publisher, and it really wasn't kind of fully resolved. So I put a lot of effort into it back then, and then I couldn't find a publisher, so I set it aside, and then I picked it up again, working with, more recently, a year, maybe 2 years ago, and worked with Rootstock Publishing here in town. To do some more work on it, and they wanted to bring it out, and I was happy to invest, the time to really finish it. It was kind of, I would say, two-thirds done back then, and it had a lot of good stuff in there, but it needed more attention. So
mm-hmm.
I haven't been working on it since 2008. I worked on it then, and then came back to it more recently.
Right. One of the features that comes very much forward is that there's a lot about relationships in the book, relationships of father and son, relationships of husbands and wives. You have Paul, the man who is murdered, and his wife, Carrie, and Fred Davis and his ex-wife, Diane. And of course, the father and son relationship of JB and his deceased father, Paul, and Fred Davis has his own relationship issues with his son and his own father. So there's a lot of relationship in there. Could you talk about that?
Okay, give me a moment to think how I would approach that. I think there aren't any characters in the book that are particular people in my life. But I think some of the things in the story, some of the relationship issues there are things that I'm familiar with in my own life. I suppose that's inevitably true in any kind of a writing project. Mm-hmm. I don't know, there are just a lot of things that I've thought a lot about. I'll give one example. JB is the son of the man who was murdered, who was a very educated, philosophical, Harvard-trained, an intellectual. And the son is an auto mechanic. And he has gone out of his way not to to follow his father's track and to follow the track of work. So to me, the issue of that's a very interesting thing is the meaning of ordinary work and how people see that. I mean, for example, I don't know if I can really explain that too well, but all of us around here, we know many, many people in our community who do physical work of various kinds. You know, they drive trucks, they operate backhoes, they're carpenters, they're plumbers. People that I work with as a builder all the time, for example, and or people like my grandfather, who was also that kind of person. And they might not describe themselves as religious necessarily, or not religious, or they might not think about things in a certain kind of abstract way that an intellectual person, a person who sees him or herself as an intellectual, would. But those people too can be extremely smart and aware and have a tremendous amount of knowledge and intuition and smarts that a person who has advanced degrees from Harvard might not have.
Right.
So I'm just interested in exploring the nature of work. So that's one of the things that I explore through these different character, particularly this character JB.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that does come out. There are several times you describe some of the police investigators and Luke driving his boat, Luke being a good friend of Fred Davis, grew up together. You describe the competence of them. Even what is his name, Fowler, one of the state troopers, you described his competence. So there's a lot of clearly respect for people who are competent in these kinds of endeavors, in building boats, in doing an investigation. That does come through, that respect that you have for people who are very well educated. They just might not be schooled. I just had a conversation with Kathleen Kessen for another program on Gathering Peace, where we talk about progressive education. And we both agreed that there are many well-educated people who did not finish high school, but they know the world in ways that some people who have advanced degrees may not know about.
And I think too, for me, that idea was a big part of what I was trying to get across in the book, is that idea, and to portray that, and particularly because in many of the novels, include not just mystery stories, but all kinds of novels, very often the people who work with their hands, who are in the trades, who perform different services, they're introduced for comic intent. So that's what I wanted part of my intention was to to set this story in ordinary life that's in a place that's on the ground, or in this case, on the water, where an awful lot of what happens is done by ordinary people who have practical experience and may or may not be, you know, college educated or whatever. But I think that was important to me. I'll just, one example, there's Wonderful Mysteries by Louise Penny. But there's a lot of ordinary folks who are popular, regulars, so to speak, on that story. But they're all a little bit seen as a little bit foolish, or as, you know, they're there for comic effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a little bit reacting to that, I'd say.
Well, the friendship.
Also, I'm interested in those things too. I just want to mention, I'm interested in practical things. I'm a carpenter. I build things.
Right.
And I love the people I've learned from who also do those things.
Right.
So, the story's a lot for them.
Well, you definitely bring that out. The relationship between Fred Davis and his best friend, Luke. Luke is a mechanic who can fix just about everything. He works on the farm. He's now Fred Davis's brother-in-law and works on the Davis farm. The description of them working together, building boats, certainly makes that point loud and clear in a very beautiful way, to the point where when at one point in the story, I don't want to give too much away, when Luke's life is in danger, I felt myself saying, "No, Sam, don't kill him." Don't kill him. Well, speaking of Luke and speaking of your connection to the water, there's a passage there on page 106 where you have Luke boating at night. He's heading back to the farm. It's dark. And your description of that moment made me realize you've spent a lot of time on the water yourself, and perhaps a lot of it in the dark. Could you read that paragraph for us where Luke is on the boat?
Oh, this is the top of 106?
Yes.
Yes. Luke, refreshed with two cups of coffee, took off in the Islander near full speed. If it wasn't raining hard, almost any boat trip was enjoyable. In a dead calm lake, a boat was smoother than any car. It could go all out. Whatever you tell the boat to do, it does without argument. But in rough water, the lake was in charge. You had to pay attention to each individual wave. It was just as much fun, but an entirely different experience. Boating in the dark was a third pleasure, a more solitary feeling. Few other boats about, and you had to watch for their lights. Without their lights on, boats were invisible at night. Now, let me just read the next sentence or two. It was in fact dead calm and the moon was out. Though the shore was just an outline, Luke could tell exactly where he was and knew every rock to avoid, every buoy to skirt port or starboard of. The cold wind felt good. And I'll stop there. Now that was very much the sort of experience that I continue to have actually and grew up having.
Yeah, that's a beautiful passage. It's a beautiful moment. And thank you for reading it. Luke is an essential part of the story insofar as that Fred Davis, his best friend, will confide in him about what's going on with the investigation. And Luke will oftentimes bring up ways of looking at things that Fred had not thought of. Luke is also in the process of trying to get Fred and his estranged wife, Diane, back together again. I was intrigued by that relationship, that the role that Luke played in the story to give Fred much more of a dimension as a person who has a life beyond being a detective investigating a murder case. So when you create these characters, how do they introduce themselves to you, and how do you develop them? Is it something you think about ahead of time and decide you're going to have these characters, or do they kind of emerge out of the writing of the story?
Well, Luke is a little bit of a special case in that my point of departure for that character was someone I grew up with, my own best friend, who died a few years ago, but who had a lot of the same qualities that I give to Luke, a lot of the same activities and interests. So that was they're really not the same, but that was certain things about the character come from my friend Tommy, who at a certain point in my life, I was very close to him, and in fact, who I spent a lot of time on the water with in different places. So, you know, I don't know where the characters come from. They I'm using my life experience and my family and the people that I know and mashing them up together in various ways. And then at a certain point, the story calls for a certain kind of character, but I really don't know. I mean, there are several characters that kind of, like, there's a character Pliny, who one of the owners of this Osprey Island. He just popped into my head all in one piece. I don't know anybody like that exactly, but I know lots of people who are a little bit like that. And he popped out with his Volvo and his house and everything. He just kind of showed up when I needed him.
Yeah.
Maybe
he plays a key role.
Characters that I planned out, but a lot of them, you know, I get to like them, and then I learn about them as the story gets written.
Right. Well, he plays a key role because
the story that really evolved during the writing that weren't planned out in the least.
That's interesting, because Pliny plays a key role insofar as the police do not know who the victim is. It's just a body, and his identification has been taken away by the killer. And they don't know who he is, and Pliny is the one who is able to identify who he is, who the killer is. So he plays a key role there. There's an awful lot of discussion about police activity, how they go about doing an investigation. Did you have to study that or learn about that, or is that something that you have in your bag of tricks already?
Actually, that's a really good question. When I first wrote the book, I just made up that stuff based on reading books and watching TV shows. Because I was interested in the story, I didn't stop to research things very much, just a little bit. But then I was encouraged by the publisher to take that further. And so I got to know Chief Tim Bombardier, who was the chief of police in Barrie, but before that was a long time state policeman. He's a retired state police. So it was actually terrific. He read the whole manuscript and made many, many suggestions about the names, about the way different police work together, how they operate, you know, what the proper name for this person or that person would be, what it would be like to work with the police in New York State, which comes up toward the end. And also it happens that he was very much knew the Inland Sea from his own, maybe he had lived up there, I'm not sure. So he was just an invaluable resource to kind of keep me from making embarrassing errors. There'll be fewer of those because he pointed me in a better direction about a lot of that. So I really did not know a lot about that. The closest I got to really, I didn't know a lot of people in police force or anything like that.
Yeah, there is a lot of detail in there, and it makes it very interesting because you go about following what they're doing, and you're getting the way they're thinking about the crime and how to cover a pretty large area with many different people that needed to be interviewed for it. The killer was very interesting to me. Certainly somebody, if you look just at his actions, somebody who seemed to have some sort of a mental problem. Was that your intention, to portray somebody who would kill as somebody who has a mental, he certainly has anger issues, let's put it that way. Could you tell us a little bit about how this character came around for you?
Well, I needed a villain. And the book is a lot about people who are pretty nice. They're flawed, but nice people. They're not too weird, not too strange. They're not too unusually anything in particular. They're regular people. But I think that there's a scene in the beginning. There's a couple of scenes in the beginning where we get introduced to this guy. One is a tennis match, and the other is this boating accident, which the story opens with a boating accident. And I think I knew two or three people that were really like that, who were casually violent. And not that those people that I knew ever, as far as I know, murdered anybody. But I have known people like that. And I think that's all I can say, is that I can think of two, maybe three people that I knew in my life pretty well, who were a little bit like that, and who could do something terrible without any remorse at all.
So that's one of the mysteries that's running through the book, is why he would kill Paul. And the other is why Paul left the family. And they seem to be parallel mysteries. I found again that to be very intriguing, to be trying to figure out, well, what happened? Why did he... This is a very successful, as you described him, Harvard-educated minister, philosophical, theological concerns, writer of books, the golden boy, he sounded like. And then one day he goes fishing and never returns. And then 18 years later, winds up back where he started from and gets murdered by a person whom he met 36 years before. So it's an intriguing, complex plot. And is it your intention to create two parallel mysteries there, or is it just in your mind woven into one mystery?
Excuse me. I think my point of departure, I'd say I had two points of departure. One was this kind of setting in this kind of place, with people on islands of this very serious, profoundly religious nature, people like that. And then I was interested, and this part, I think, people who, and there have been a number of people in my family like this, and maybe I'm one of them, I don't know, for whom you come from a place where your fate, the meaning of life, your being a good person, being at peace with the world at your moment of death, are the most important, and treating other people very well, that those things are the most important thing in your life. A certain quest for a certain kind of purity. And I think that that's something that is a thread that runs through New England philosophy and New England religion, and certainly in different ways in my own family, my parents, my grandparents, to their parents. So I was interested in how, you know, in 1820, it might be perfectly reasonable to be that kind of person. A person who, you know, who seeks for perfection, has a prominent seat at the front of the church every Sunday and all of that. But it's a little harder to do that now. It's a little harder to do that in the 1960s and 70s and 80s and 90s. It's a little harder to be that kind of person. You know, if you were that kind of person in the 1940s or the 30s, you were a person of authority. That was the ideal. Now it's not. So it's just a dilemma that I have explored a lot, which I can't articulate very well. I have to say, I can't really put my finger on this very well. But I'm interested in exploring those family relationships and those kinds of aspirations that people that I knew and that I still know had, and how that played out in this world that we live in. And I think also too, it comes back to the lake being on the water. And I can't articulate that, except that I know that that's a theme that goes through the lives of all of these people that I know that are like that. You know, they seek some kind of solace and meaning. That being on the water is like a metaphor for life in some way for people. So as you can see, I'm stumbling over trying to explain this.
No, it's
but it's still, even though I'm still stumbling over those things, but nonetheless, that is the answer to your question. Yes. That was my point of departure, was the place and people that I'm not very well describing.
Well, you do it in the book very well, and I really appreciated when we find out what may have motivated Paul, that's the fellow who leaves and comes back and is killed, when we find out about it, it's done as speculation, and it's done because Fred Davis, the detective, becomes very interested in Paul. In fact, I saw some parallels between Paul and Fred, but we don't need to go there. We're not told definitively, because I think the nature of what you're describing, and one of the reasons why you may be having a hard time describing it, is this is very elusive stuff. It's not stuff you can nail down. It's not like a piece of wood that you can shape, and you have a beautiful piece in there where you talk about wood, and I'll read that piece later on page 197. Life doesn't get nailed down that simply. It doesn't get shaped the way a piece of wood gets shaped or a metal is shaped. It's very hard. So when we do find out what may have been the motivation why Paul left, it's speculative. His wife, his former wife, his widow, I guess, at this point, reveals something. But we don't know that that was the reason he left. It's speculation, it probably. But what that did to him when he heard the news she had for him opened up places in him that I think all of us struggle with, this idea of being good, being virtuous, and being authentic. And maybe they're not always the same. You have a point where Pliny talks about Helen, Paul's sister, and Pliny, who has a great deal of love for the family because his best friend was the father of Helen and Paul, recognizes that sometimes Helen seems a little false. And maybe Paul found out something about himself and had to find that. And that's a hard thing to both describe and to also live with. And I appreciated the way you handled that. It made for a very, very, very interesting part of the story that you create for us. I'm talking with Sam Clark. He has a mystery book out, a murder mystery book called The Inland Sea. And those of you who are familiar with Lake Champlain will really enjoy reading about what life could have been like and maybe still is like for people who live on Lake Champlain. But it's also a wonderful, engaging story about people trying to find out why and how a person who disappeared for a while is back where he started from, but found dead. So, Sam, we have a few more minutes. Is there anything else you want to say about the book that, anything about the book that when you're thinking about it now, you feel particularly good about, or maybe something you'd say, well, if I had it to do over again, I'd redo that. Is there anything like that that you want to share with us before we have to?
I really like the points, the features of it, the points of it that you just brought out, actually. There's a place in the story where Pliny has to find out that this person has been killed, and he has to, falls to him to call and talk to his different family members about what's happened, which will be a shock and a surprise to most of these people, you know, family members. And I guess I felt that that was, for me, and you just mentioned that part of the story, that seemed like, oh, I really got that part worked best. That's the part of the book that it's a series of phone calls and little conversations between Pliny and these other people who were close to the man who dies. Mm-hmm. And that felt to me like, in a nutshell, that was really what the book was about, was the different perceptions that different characters had about the man who dies, and how all of them are valid. All of these different characters have I've never really thought about it this way until right now, but that they all have a different view of what this person was like. And they're all true in one way or another, but they're very different. And there are other things like that that you learn as the story goes on after that. But I think that for me was an important part of it. And I really appreciate the things that in the story that you pulled out are the things that are of particular interest to me, or that particularly reflect what I was trying to do in writing it. But what I cared most, got most involved in, you create these characters, and then you start to care about them, and you want things to work out. You get attached. You make up something, and then you get attached to that character.
Like I said, I didn't want you to kill off Luke.
Exactly. Well, I never would have done that. I wouldn't have wanted to do that. And I
I think you create some people that you do begin to care about them, because there's a certain authenticity to them. And I think it relates back to what you were saying before about people who know how to get by in the world, who know how to do things. They're not just thinkers and talkers. They're people who actually do things, create things, and do things. Those are very attractive people that you created. I just want to read this one piece here because it made me think of you, Sam. Obviously, I'm thinking of you. You wrote the book, but it made me think of you as a woodworker. Fred found working on the boat soothing. He wasn't a great mechanic. He left that for Luke when he could. But he had always enjoyed the woodworking part. He suspected that he might be better at it than at detecting or lawyering, which had been the original life plan. He got along well with wood, a straight, rectilinear piece of wood might initially complain when asked to assume the tapered, curved shape required of boat parts. But once it got the idea, it would cooperate. Sometimes it was a more satisfactory relationship than he had with people or cows. I thought of you about that. Is that your relationship to wood, Sam?
You know, Fred's a better woodworker than I am. I never got to that boat building level myself. I'm good at what I do, but I have always admired the people who do boats, which seems to me to be a couple of, or musical instruments for that matter, a couple of just very admirable kind of skill. So I kind of gave that skill to this character because it's something, it sort of fit the story too, because we're dealing with boats. And then I had this idea of this, that Luke and Fred have this little small time boat business. And that was great for me too, because that enabled me to talk about all the wonderful boats that they had, that they, these two characters, they repair old boats. That's a little side business, that one of them is a policeman and one is a farmer that they have. And that's it, which is entirely possible that that could happen with people like that. But so I populate their shop with boats that I wish that I had had. There's a boat called a Lyman Islander, which they fix up when they're 13 or 14. Well, I love the Lyman Islander. I don't have a Lyman Islander. I will never have a Lyman Islander. But by giving them one on paper, I get to enjoy. And it's a lot easier to write about than to do it, because I'm not that kind of woodworker. I'm good with straight lines and square cuts. But I have a feeling, obviously, I have a feeling for woodworking. I've been doing it all my life. So.
Yeah. No, the way you talked about the wood going along with it, it was quite clear you have an intimate relationship with wood. Well, while you enjoyed writing the book, I'm glad to hear that you put in things that you really enjoyed. You created a book that is very, very enjoyable to read. And so I've been talking with Sam Clark. His book is The Inland Sea. It's a mystery. It's published by Rootstock Publishing. They're located in Montpelier, Vermont, and it comes out on December 9th. So Sam, thank you so much for writing the book and for being with us here together on Gathering Peace.
Well, thank you so much for having me here and for actually giving it such a wonderful, careful, thoughtful reading. Thank you.
Well, it was my pleasure, believe me. And now this brief announcement from Zara Zueguest from the Beth Jacob Synagogue.
Beth Jacob Synagogue would like to invite the community to Shine a Light for Social Justice series this year for Hanukkah. This year, on each of the 8 nights of Hanukkah, members of the Beth Jacob Synagogue community who have volunteered to be lighting leaders will light a menorah on Zoom to shine a light on one social justice issue each night. We invite the community to join us for these lightings and stand in solidarity with the marginalized people in our country. We are excited to be welcoming community partners on many of the nights, including the Anti-Defamation League, Downstreet Housing and Community Development, Central Vermont Refugee Action Network, Community Harvest of Central Vermont, and more. In order to sign up for this series, we invite you to come to bethjacobvt.org/shinealight, and you will get the Zoom link to join us on any of the nights that is of interest to you. We'll be covering social justice issues, including racial justice, LGBTQ rights, economic justice, the climate crisis, mental health, food security, religious freedom and anti-Semitism, and immigrant justice. And we hope that you'll join us.
So these are all start at 5:30, except for the December 11th, LGBTQ rights starts at 4 p.m.
That's correct. Last year we did this in person, but this year everything will be on Zoom. All so right. We just ask that you go to bethjacobvt.org/shinealight and sign up to get your Zoom invite.
Well, that's great. It sounds like a great program. Thank you, Sarah, for being with us on Gathering Peace. I'd like to share a few thoughts with you, our listeners. The pandemic and lockdown we are experiencing are having profound effects personally and socially. They also remind us of the power of community. Community may be something we take for granted. Like the air we breathe, it is there, but invisible, and not given much thought until we are without it. Then suddenly, its importance is undeniable, and a wave of gratitude for its existence washes over us. Unlike air, though, community takes effort on our part in order to exist. We make community as we live it. The give and take of human relations, acts of kindness, sharing, arguing, simple greetings, and when needed, coming to the aid of neighbors and others whom we may not even know. The infrastructure of community, our schools, places of worship, businesses, places where we work, clubs, sports teams, concerts, art exhibits, public spaces, and other venues where we can come together, provide a framework where community is built and nourished. Our communication media, newspapers, social media, email, newsletters, bulletins, TV, and radio provide the means for sharing news and thoughts about our common life. Community radio is very intentional in its goal of fostering community conversations and providing a place where we can come together to enjoy local and worldwide music. In central Vermont, WGDR, community radio from Goddard College, plays that role. Staff and volunteers at WGDR are very clear about and devoted to the role we play in fostering community. We take it as a given that we have made an unwritten agreement with listeners that our efforts are in the service of strengthening community ties through excellent programming. WGDR Community Radio is truly an amateur effort. It's an effort of love. The bottom line for all of us at the station is building, fostering, and nurturing community. The scores of volunteer programmers spend hours preparing our shows out of love for sharing music and or providing information to listeners we think is needed to strengthen our democracy, enliven our institutions, deepen our understanding of life and living, and to be sure, nurture our community. We believe that listeners, as part of the unwritten agreement, agree not only to listen to your favorite shows, after all, that is the point of doing radio, but to support the station in various ways. Support takes different forms. Responding to listener surveys to help improve what we do. Contacting the station to criticize what you do not like and encourage what you find helpful. Supporting businesses who underwrite our programming and encouraging others to do so. And when possible, providing financial support to the station. We are so grateful to be able to say, you have held up your end of the agreement. Now, we ask you to again step up and support your community radio station, WGDR, WGDH, with a financial gift so we can continue to bring you the music, news, and commentary you have come to expect. Through our nationally syndicated shows such as Democracy Now!, Making Contact, The Tom Hartman Show, Alternative Radio with David Barsamian, Big Picture Science, and more, WGDR brings the world into your home and community. Volunteer programmers who are community members keep you informed about local and statewide news and events, how to be a successful gardener, and music of just about every genre and many cultures. WGDR understands, and our programming reflects, that our local community is tied to the much larger national and global communities, demonstrating that fostering community need not be a parochial effort. Your donation will support WGDR and WGDH's continued commitment to locally produced community media and to the national news and grassroots programming of the Pacifica Radio Network. Donations can be made securely at WGDR.org or by sending a check to WGDR, 123 Pitkin Road, Plainfield, Vermont, 05667. And thank you. Thank you very much.